That was Morning Glory on 95 BFM.
BFM News.
Ahiahi marie, good afternoon. Ko Zoe toku ingoa, ko te tekauma roa karaka. It's 12 o'clock. Yesterday, Aotearoa reached a vaccination milestone of 75% full inoculation across the eligible population. In Tāmaki Makaurau, 84% of the Auckland DHB is now fully vaccinated. This is compared to 80% of the Waitamata DHB and 77% of Counties Manukau. Approximately 5,000 people need their first dose and 140,000 people need to get their second dose in Auckland to reach the 90% target. The Māori vaccine rollout continues to fall behind, with 72% having a first dose and only 52% being fully vaccinated across all regions. There were 143 cases of COVID-19 reported yesterday, 135 in Auckland, 6 in Waikato and 2 in Northland. The government is set to make an announcement this afternoon about whether restrictions will ease in Auckland and Waikato. In international news, the United Kingdom and France are still in dispute over permits for fishing licences. This Tuesday is the deadline for more licences to be granted to French fishing vehicles to use British waters. If these licences are not granted, French officials have warned that British fishing boats could be prevented from using French ports. Both UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have both said the ball is in the other nation's court. French officials have said the pair have agreed to work together to come to a solution in the next hours and days. A new training program is seeking to protect Mount Augustus or Berengaria, a large rock in Australia's Western Territory. Berengaria is about 850 kilometres northeast of Perth. It's 14 kilometres long and 5 kilometres wide at its widest point. The program is seeking to train Aboriginal rangers to preserve the area's cultural history and educate tourists how to walk safely to see ancient rock carvings and waterholes. Berengaria is widely unknown despite being twice as big as the world-famous Uluru in the Northern Territory. However, it has currently seen a large influx of Western Australian tourists who cannot leave the state due to COVID-19 restrictions. And that's the news.
A 95 BFM weather update.
Āne ngā tohu huarere mō tēnei rā. Your weather report for Rahina, Monday the 1st of November. Mostly then partly cloudy this morning with scattered showers. Southwesterly winds becoming south-southwesterly. A high of 19 degrees and an overnight low of 9. Sunset today will be at 52 minutes past 7. Āne ngā tohu huarere mō ngā atu rā e toru. Ratu, Tuesday, mostly fine and partly cloudy, south-southwesterlies becoming west-southwesterlies. Rapa, Wednesday, mostly cloudy and cooler with some rain possible and fresh south-southeasterlies. And Rapare, Thursday, mostly cloudy with chance of a shower, south-easterlies becoming east-southeasterlies. That was your news and weather, ko Zoe Aho. Thanks very much to Emma for remote writing this morning's bulletin. And the time is now 4 minutes past 12.
That was a 95 BFM weather update, thanks to climate change.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 1st of November. If you can't already tell by my voice, I'm back. I'm so excited to be back in the studio, you guys, you have no idea. It's been still really fun producing in lockdown, but there's nothing quite like being back in the studio. I'll be with you for the next hour. This week, I'm going to be speaking to Robin Twemlow and Sean Windmill from the Tourette's Association of New Zealand about why they are calling for the Ministry of Health to consider Tourette's syndrome as a disability. I'll also be speaking to Drowning Prevention Auckland about the gap between perception and reality when it comes to water competency for adults. This week, Louis is away, so producer Joe Wickens is going to be taking over. He'll be speaking with Letitia Harding from the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation about their latest research on youth vaping, and Lisa Woods from Amnesty International about Aotearoa Justice Watch. And we have another piece from Christina Huang, who will be continuing her regular segment with the Waitemata Local Board. This week, she speaks to board member Karen Leone. He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today, so please give me a text or a call. I'd love to chat with some of you. So tuku patuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 Waiamarani or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka awa I wariwari I ahe ana koutou ti whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō he pakehere roki mā runga e te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM e da kati.com. You can catch all our stories today and more by podcast on our website as always. Let's get into it.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
The Tourette's Association of New Zealand has recently launched a petition asking for the Ministry of Health to recognise Tourette's syndrome as a physical disability. I spoke to Robin Twemlow and Sean Windmill, who is a person with Tourette's syndrome, about why the lack of support services currently available is something that needs to be addressed.
Would you just mind telling our listeners who might not be aware a bit about what Tourette syndrome is and what that means, I guess, for you specifically?
Yeah. So Tourette syndrome is a neurological condition that basically kind of causes a bunch of physical and motor tics, which are kind of non-voluntary movements or sounds that can be something as simple as just blinking your eyes too much, to shouting out full sentences, to sometimes getting body paralysis tics where you can't move your legs or walk. And they very much range all over the place and can be pretty unpredictable.
With the Tourette's Association of New Zealand, what prompted you to want to start this?
My daughter was diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome when she was 9. And at the time, when I went searching for some help and support, there was nothing. So as needs must, I just sort of started up my own association and went seeking other parents. And at the time, it was obviously very new. So the people that were contacting me had lived with Tourette's for a long time. And then there were some new people that might have had kids or might have only been diagnosed for a year or so. And then it's just growing now that we're generally speaking the first port of call when, say, parents start noticing their kids starting to tick or what have you. So they tend to come to us first because we are the only sort of support or information service out there for people living with Tourette syndrome or to any tick disorder, really.
And you're calling for the Ministry of Health to recognise Tourette syndrome as a disability. Why is it important for Tourette to be officially recognised as a disability?
So obviously, Sean and I have slightly different stories in that I'm a parent of a child with Tourette syndrome. Annalise, as I say, was 9 when she was diagnosed. It took a few years to get that diagnosis. Fortunately, we were already in the mental health system, but she has ADHD and anxiety as well. But at the time, her tics were quite severe. She couldn't walk. She wasn't going to school very often. She was hurting herself a lot. So the only sort of management we were given was a medication, and one was an antipsychotic, and the other one was to lower blood pressure. So the theory being that they would just, you know, suppress the ticks and that type of thing. If we'd had funding available, like disability funding, for example, we would have had other options. We would have been able to get cognitive therapy as opposed to just pharmaceutical therapy. She may have been then able to qualify to go to health school while she was missing out on school. Ironically, I was unemployed at the time, which was fortunate because it meant I could care for her at home. I've heard of stories where people have had to remortgage their homes so that they could stay at home with their child when their child hasn't been able to go to school. If it was recognised as a disability, those families could apply for individualised funding or carer support where they could have employed someone to stay home with their kids rather than having to quit their own jobs. Or when I say older, anyone who's over the age of 18, you know, they could get support to move out of home, to get in-home care, to get help with mobility issues, get help with employment. For the Tourette's Association in itself, you know, we rely on fundraising and donations because it's not a disability, therefore we can't apply for health funding.
So, Sian, then I guess for you personally as a young person, what would having Tourette's syndrome be considered a disability mean for you in your own life?
It would just open up so many different options and pathways for me. At 19, I'm kind of at the age where I should be looking into moving out and figuring out careers and stuff like that. But I've kind of had to slow all of that down because with how draining and taxing my physical tics can be, I don't have enough energy to do those kinds of things. And sort of basic looking after yourself activities have just become so much harder. I can't consistently cook for myself because handling knives isn't always the safest. There are like basic sort of part-time jobs are just kind of outer limits for me. That it would just give me a chance to be able to deal with living until, and so I can focus on those living a regular life.
And what has prevented Tourette's syndrome from being looked at as a disability until now?
One of the issues that has sort of prevented it being looked at as a physical disability was that until quite recently it's still been considered a mental health disorder, but it's not a mental health condition because it is neurological and it's inherited. Quite frankly, no one's ever asked in New Zealand for it to be considered a disability before, so this is sort of the first time that anyone's sort of put it on the table.
Yeah, you get a lot of assumptions, especially I think for the younger folks, that it's behavioural, that you get teachers and even parents and stuff who, even though they see it and they've been told what it is, they just can't seem to figure out that it is fully uncontrollable. And I think also with lots of people who are only tangentially aware of Tourette's, you hear it as the swearing condition first, which I think people don't realise that it is so much more than that. It interferes with a lot of day-to-day living. It's not just occasionally shouting out a rude word or whatever.
And a lot of those tics, you know, can be situational as well. You can shout out stuff that you don't have any intention of saying. I mean, basically, Tourette syndrome to break it down into the most basic, is, you know, the filter that we all have in our brain is kind of faulty for people with Tourette. So they might say or do something that the rest of us wouldn't do.
It's kind of like all the background noise in your head that you're not even really aware of gets turned into a word association game. So a lot of the time, like, it will sound like I'm ticking, like I'm actually saying something because it fits into the context of the conversation or what's going around, but it's just because that little randomized generator in your head that's going through every single option is just picking one out and making me do it.
Sian, what would your sort of hope for the future as a person living with Tourette's be?
At the moment, just because there aren't that many options, it's so easy to feel like you're the person who's failing at life that surely if it wasn't your fault, then there'd be help for this kind of thing. And so there actually being help would not only alleviate all the physical pressures, but I think as a person living with it, it would just feel a whole lot better. It would just give me choices in what I want to do instead of just having to settle for what is the only option physically possible to me.
Yeah.
Right. And really well said. Really well said, Sian. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Robin, just yes. If people want to support the association and the petition, how can they do that?
They can go to our website, which is tourettes.org.nz, because it has the link there to the parliamentary petition, and they can just follow that through from there and just sign it and share it and let everyone else in the world know that we're doing it.
And that was Robin Twemlow and Sian Windmill from the Tourette's Association of New Zealand. I had a great time talking to them the other day at home. And you can learn more about the petition on their Facebook page, where I've heard from them that they're apparently giving away Snoop Dogg concert tickets. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, maybe check that out. Next up, we have a piece from Joe. And in this piece, the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation and the Secondary Principals Association released their recent study on vaping amongst youth in New Zealand. Apparently, the study was New Zealand's biggest vaping survey, with 19,000 students from years 9 to 13 participating. The survey was carried out due to growing concerns from schools, teachers, and parents over vaping and smoking habits. Joe speaks to Letitia Harding, the chief executive of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation, about the findings of the study.
So tell me about this study's findings.
Yeah, I suppose for us, some of the concerning findings are, well, the number of youth actually vaping out there, and the fact that it's actually increased quite a lot. 27% of those reported vaping, and actually 15% even reported smoking traditional cigarettes in the past week. So those were quite alarming statistics. And also the concentration of nicotine in the vapes that, the students are vaping with. Yeah, so the nicotine levels were a really interesting finding that, over 79%, so we're actually having nicotine vapes at very high concentrations, so around 24 to 50 milligrams, that is quite an addictive level of nicotine. And the other thing, of course, is, the accessing from dairies, which, is a huge concern.
Vaping started off as an alternative to smoking, and somewhat harmless. Now that it's become its own thing, do you think it's causing just as much harm as far as nicotine addiction goes?
Yeah, I think the issue is that, we've never been a strong proponent of these being the magic bullet for people to stop smoking anyway. Actually, the only evidence surrounding people using vapes to quit smoking is when it's with intense sort of wraparound behavioural support. And that's when, traditional sort of MedSafe approved products have failed. We also know that a lot of people, of course, are smoking and vaping together. So we call that, dual smoking and vaping. That's actually a big concern in New Zealand. They're not sort of using vaping to transition from smoking and then quit vaping. So we also know that these high nicotine levels, they're a lot higher than the nicotine that you would get in a packet of cigarettes. So the concerning thing for us is that we have parents talking to us and saying, their kids are going through a vaping pod in sort of 2 to 3 hours. And if you're thinking that, a pack of cigarettes, you're getting around sort of 36 milligrams of nicotine, and from these sort of vapes between 24 and 50 milligrams, if a young person is doing that within 2 to 3 hours, then, it is a real problem, and it is certainly potential to become addicted, as we're seeing from from the results of this survey. And, you know, that's a huge concern. They were introduced, I believe, just under the veil of a sort of quit smoking. And, you know, we haven't seen the rates of smoking go down, considering how long vapes have been around and accessible in New Zealand, that you would expect. And now we've got a new generation of kids we know are addicted to nicotine.
Who would you say is in a better position to deal with a situation like this? You know, do parents need to make a conscious effort to ensure that kids aren't getting hooked on these products, as well as schools ensuring that students aren't vaping?
I think that, you know, getting information and education out there is really key. I think that you're right, as you said in the beginning, vaping was seen, and especially by young people, as being harmless. You know, and that's how it's sort of been depicted for some time, and incorrectly so. You know, it may be less harmful than cigarette smoking, but it's not harmless. And in fact, we know now more and more evidence of the effects that it does have on the heart and lungs, the negative effects. So we also know that schools are going to drastic actions, putting in sort of vaping detectors in the toilets. You know, there's no vaping or smoking, of course, on the school ground. So the Principals Association, the schools are really trying to stamp this out. And, you know, it's concerning when we looked through this, you can tell by the frequency of the vaping, kids are doing it at lunchtime, and they're often quite discreet products too. You know, they're very sleek looking, a lot of these single use products. They look like a little sort of USB type stick, and so they can be quite discreet. They're not always a big plume of vape that comes out for them. And and you can tell from the results of this study with 86% of students who are vaping more than once a day reporting they felt addicted to vaping and had some adverse effect on their health. I mean, it is a concern, and we need to really be educating on that as much as possible.
The study also touched on the effect vaping has on mental health. Can you touch on this?
Yeah, I mean, you can get vape products with zero nicotine in them. However, they don't tend to be, as you can tell from the data here, only 2.8% were actually using zero nicotine products. So they do tend to be going for higher nicotine products anyway. And nicotine does have an effect on the developing brain. There's enough papers out there that show that, especially, you know, teenagers where that development is still happening. Concentration, nicotine is well known to have an adverse effect on this. And we know, of course, the effect on lung tissue, circulatory system, and long-term studies we don't know yet with vaping, things like they talk about with, you know, cigarettes and carcinogenic and toxins and things like that. The long-term effects of that will still take some time. But, you know, the adverse effects are in black and white, and we've got so many published papers now. You know, you shouldn't be picking up a vape and getting addicted to it. They were supposed to be introduced as an answer for quit smoking. However, smoking hasn't declined in the rate that you would expect it to with these vapes. And now we've got a whole other problem out there, as the survey shows.
Looking to the future, what are some of the ways which could help prevent children from being able to pick up vapes so easily?
I mean, it may be we've heard from parents, and you remember that we hear from concerned parents in schools all the time about this. Maybe just having the three flavours in dairies isn't the answers. You know, maybe we actually need to ban vapes in dairies as well. That may be something to go a bit further, because we know that some small general stores are actually dedicating a whole section of their store and converting it to a vape retailing premises. So we've heard of stories of parents going into their equivalent of a dairy where they've got those claw machines for kids, and right next door they've got vape products now. So maybe we need to go further and actually ban access of them in dairies, and they should only be sold in specialist vape retail stores. And maybe we also need to cap the limit of those around the country. We've certainly got over 600 listed transitional vape retailers around the country, and you know, that is a lot. And I think curbing the how close they are to schools is really important as well. That's something that will help. And then we need to look at ways to educate youth that these aren't harmless products, that they do have negative health effects, and then actually help kids who are now addicted to nicotine. And we've got stories from parents who are talking about this, saying that their kid is basically addicted to nicotine and there's nowhere to get help. And so we now need to start looking at that as well.
And that was Letitia Harding talking to Joe. And they encourage, if you want to get educated on vaping and its impact on you, that you can visit their website, don'tgetsuckedin.co.nz. And we'll be back right after this short break.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need, brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more.
There's never been a better time for vinyl, and there's never been a better time to support your local independent record store. Southbound Records. Order now at southbound.co.nz for courier delivery or contactless pickup at 132 Simon Street. Walking
home. It's music.
95.
We're an underground radio station here, and we bring the truth.
Original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
No, but I own all the utilities, so it's actually times 10.
Board games on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of the Waitimata local board.
When it comes to politics, the mahi that goes on at the local democracy level often goes unnoticed. On this segment, we take a closer look into what the public servants of the Waitemata Local Board do to keep our communities thriving. On The Wire this week, I spoke to board member Corinne Leone about the board's Māori outcomes portfolio, the presence of colonial statues in the Waitemata, and getting rangatahi more involved in politics.
Ahiahi Maria, good afternoon, Corinne.
Kia ora, Christina. It's really lovely to kōrero with you today.
First of all, what is your role within the board?
So I hold two portfolios. So my first portfolio is the lead on Māori outcomes, and the second portfolio I hold is arts, events and culture. So I really enjoy both of those portfolios. Māori outcomes has been very new for the board, so it's been exciting to get into that mahi and to look at how we can really make some changes within the Waitemata local board around our engagement with Māori as well.
And how would you describe the relationship between the Waitemata Local Board and other local boards, as well as the Auckland Council? How do they all tie together?
I think the best way to describe it is that it's an ongoing relationship that we have with all of the local boards. And, you know, we have so much in common in what we're wanting and hoping to achieve around our vision of Tamaki Makaurau in the future going forward. So I would say the relationship with the councillors that we do have good relationships with and continue to build on is very strong. And it's so important to have those relationships with the local boards to understand, you know, the mahi that they're doing around Tamaki Makaurau and how we can complement each other, how we can learn from each other, and how we can continue to look at different ways we can engage with our constituents and our local communities.
So as head of the Māori Outcomes portfolio, what is your vision in terms of achieving better, more equitable outcomes for the Māori community?
Oh, look, we've got so much mahi to do in the space of Māori outcomes, and given that it's the first time that the local board have actually held a Māori outcomes portfolio, I would say that this is the initial period of us really working on looking at equity issues, especially for our whānau who are a majority Māori in the city centre, our homeless whānau, rough sleepers. But we also have a significant amount of Māori businesses within the Waitemata as well. So we're currently looking at having hui with our Māori organisations that are already operating within the Waitemata, working with our mana whenua. So we have 15 key iwi within our boundaries that we hold regular hui and invite them along via Zoom. So we're just initiating some of those relationships. Pippa Coombe, who was the previous board chair, already had a great relationship with Ngāti Whātua, but we're definitely building on that and wanting to address a lot of those equity issues, but also build those relationships between non-Māori and Māori in the local community, because I think as a country, we're really moving towards the whole nation wanting to learn more about the culture, being aware of the equity issues, but also, you know, people really wanting to engage with te reo Māori, with kapa haka, understanding the culture and everything that comes with it. So yeah, those are some of the things that we're looking to work on.
And one of the main issues facing Māori at the moment is this inequitable vaccine rollout. Are there any plans to tackle that?
Actually, we are looking to have a Zoom hui with some of the board members from the Auckland District Council, ourselves, and if we can get some MPs along, that would be great as well. So we know that it's definitely an issue, more so in counties Manukau. Obviously, we've already hit the 90% for our local board area for the Auckland District Health Board, which is great news. But whatever we can do to tautoko and support our other local boards in South Auckland, I think it's really important that we look at some opportunities and ways to tautoko them going forward.
One of the issues you're also involved with includes the presence of colonial statues in the Waitemata area, and some people have raised concerns about that. Could you tell us what your plans are to address this?
Yes, so we've been very clear that we want to provide an opportunity for mana whenua to come together and to kōrero about all of the statues within the Waitemata boundaries. Unfortunately, at the moment, Ngāti Whātua are quite overwhelmed with mahi, so they're not able to do that in the near future. But we know that that is something that we're wanting to address and come back to that when Ngāti Whātua have got a bit more time to sit down at the table and kōrero about those issues. But it's a priority for us as a local board. I mean, we know that there's, you know, some inappropriate signage that is connected with some of the statues in our area, and we definitely want to review and look at signage that's inappropriate and get that addressed. So we're very proactive when it comes to looking at a lot of these current issues within our society that are changing now, and trying to really work with mana whenua to work through them and really get some good outcomes going forward. It'd be great to have more Māori statues and Māori signage of history as well around the Waitemata.
So would you say that your role as leader of the Arts, Culture and Heritage portfolio, that's linked with that as well?
Yes, absolutely. So we've had a lot of events around Matariki that have been held. We've got Te Reo Māori that's being held in the city centre. We've got some great annual events that are held, the Festival Italiano, the Rose Festival held in Parnell. Obviously, a lot of these have had to be put off over COVID, but we have some really great events that we hold on an annual basis within Waitemata that we're really, really proud of, and we know brings communities together from right across Tamaki Makaurau.
And obviously, representation in politics is incredibly important. How would you encourage rangatahi to get more involved in leadership positions at the local level or even above?
I just strongly believe that we need to start the whole engagement around local government politics or politics in general in schools, because from my perspective, I know that a lot of that information is not always readily available to our rangatahi in schools or in universities. Obviously, our students are getting their heads more around politics and the influence that it has on our day-to-day lives. And we know that politics really impacts our lives every single day and a lot of the decisions we're making. If you're living in a house, if you're catching transport, all of those things come back to political decisions. So it's trying to encourage our rangatahi that politics, one, is actually positive to be involved in, because I think a lot of our rangatahi find it quite overwhelming when they just see everything on media. But setting up programs to get rangatahi involved in local government is definitely one aspiration or dream that I'd love to work towards, and have some kind of program available if young people wanted to come through our local board and get an experience of what it's like. I'd really welcome those ideas and to work with our young people around designing what that could look like.
Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Karen.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure speaking to you and having a good kōrero.
That was Corinne Leone, head of the Māori Outcomes Portfolio on the Waitemata Local Board, speaking to us about how the board is striving towards equity for Māori in the Waitemata and the road to better representation in politics.
That's not a ladder, that's an upside down snake.
Board Games on 95 BFM.
The 95 BFM merch shop is now open.
Positively overflowing with everything you need to be the coolest kid in school, or work, or your flat, whatever.
Shirts, beanies, hoodies, caps, totes, face masks, all proudly emblazoned with the good old 95 BFM logo, and all available for a strictly limited time.
But that's not all.
We've also hooked up an exclusive, once-in-a-lifetime, extremely good-looking shirt designed by the one and only Anand Unka.
Everything is made to order, so once it's gone, it's gone. The shop closes this Sunday. So what are you waiting for? Go to 95bfm.com/merch.
Electric Kiwi and 95BFM bring you recorded, produced and mastered RPM. Searching for Aotearoa's most electric talent.
Whether you play metal or the good stuff, if you're a musician, whatever your genre, we want to hear your demos.
And if we like them, you could win a weekend at 95BFM recording two tracks with our excellent engineers Rick Breeze and Big Hungry.
But that's not all. You'll get your songs pressed to fresh 7-inch vinyl by Holiday Records. Plus, you'll be playing at Nest Fest 2022, New Zealand's leading boutique independent music festival in the sunny Hawke's Bay.
RPM on BFM thanks to Electric Kiwi and Nest Fest.
Enter now.
Show us
electric talent. Email your tracks to rpm@95bfm.com.
Recorded, produced, mastered, RPM. Go to 95bfm.com or find Electric Kiwi on Facebook and comment with your video.
So you've found that adults think that they're more competent in water than they actually are, particularly in open water. Why might this be?
Well, there's a myriad of reasons around why it is, but it was really quite exciting research because it was the first time that we'd put people into a pool and tested how good they were, and then put them in the open water and tested how good they were as well. So, and either side of that, we asked them how good they thought they were. And we tested different competencies like floating and getting in and getting out of the water and swimming. And so we found a number of gaps, if you like, in their perception and what's actually the case. And one of them was that people thought that to be safe, they may only need to be able to swim 25 metres. You know, if we put ourselves in a situation in the open water and we could only swim 25 metres, then that may not be enough to keep ourselves safe from drowning. People also thought that they wouldn't need to be able to float that long to be safe. But in actual fact, you might have to wait 2 or 3 minutes for a rescue to come in, you know, to save you. So we found there was that difference between how good people thought they would be just to be safe. Then we also found there was a gap between how good they thought they were and what they could do in a pool. And then the biggest gap was what they could do in a pool and what they could actually do in open water. And that was probably the biggest predictor that, you know, we really do need to prepare ourselves in a pool before going into open water, and respecting that actually what we can do in the pool doesn't necessarily reflect what we may be able to do in open water.
Right. So we've had some recent tragic drownings even over this COVID lockdown. So what situations might adults find themselves in that they're not as prepared for as they might think they are?
Yeah, they're really tragic, those five in such a short time frame. And I guess some of that COVID lockdown adds to the complexity of drowning, because there's been a gap between, you know, being able to get out into open water and being able to practice and checking your equipment and all those kinds of things. And then you've got the other side of the coin going, well, I haven't been out for so long. I really want to go, and it's a beautiful day and I really want to go. Or maybe it wasn't such a beautiful day, but they had their heart set on going, and so they just went anyway. So, you know, that the lockdown could add levels or layers of risk to how we may otherwise think of a situation.
And because in Auckland in particular, where we are at 95BFM, we're in lockdown, so we haven't been able to use those public facilities like pools. But when those do open up, or for people who have access, what are some of the things that they could maybe do? You mentioned becoming more competent in the pool first to better protect themselves.
You know, really recommend going to a pool and just seeing how good you actually are. And it's not that you're right or wrong or you're good or bad, but it's assessing your own level of what you can do in the water. And you might, for example, see if you can float. You know, perhaps you haven't tried it for 10 years or 20 years. And so let's just go to a pool and see if you can float, see how long you could float for. Try different positions, try taking your life jacket, see the difference that that makes. You could also try swimming a distance, see how far you can make it or in what time, you know, before putting your feet on the bottom. One thing that people often forget is how difficult it may be to climb back onto a kayak or a boat that's overturned. So perhaps practice climbing out over the side of the pool. Can you do that? There are all sorts of things that you can actually test yourself with and see what you can do in a pool before you put yourself in the open water.
And Drowning Prevention Auckland has launched a new internet learning module for adults. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. It's a free module and it just gives you a whole lot of ideas and advice about being in the open water. And they're really short little video clips, and then there's some learning around that, around each clip, and a couple of tests if you would like to follow that through. And, you know, it follows all sorts of activities in open water, from open water swimming. There's one module on paddling, so that's kayaking and stand-up paddle boarding. There's another module on surfing and snorkeling, and one on boating. So it takes in the whole scope of, if you like, of activities in open water, and just some really good clear advice about how to keep yourself safe.
Yes, and if people want to check that out before they hit the water this summer, where can they find that?
On Drowning Prevention Auckland website, and if you click on the e-learning button that's at the top of that web page, you can access the module free of charge.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
And that was researcher Teresa Stanley talking about Drowning Prevention Auckland's new module, which aims to address the gap between perception and reality when it comes to water competency. Gosh, I don't know the last time I went swimming was. It was probably about 2 years ago. So I definitely will need to check out that module if I plan to get back in the water anytime soon.
That was The Wire.
And that's a wrap on today's Wire. Ko ira te hōtaka, katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi ki a koutou, katoa I kōrero, mai ki o mō tēnei rā. Thank you so much to everyone who spoke with us today. Robin Twemlow and Sean Windmill, Letitia Harding, Karen Leonley, and Teresa Stanley. And if you have any thoughts on our pieces today, give me a text. I'll be around for the next few minutes, or give me a call, or you can check out, as always, our pieces from today on the on our website by podcasts. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thank you for tuning in. Ka hoki mai mātou a te ra wiki. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny. You're listening to 95BFM.